Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. This is our fourth edition of Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, and I'm joined today again by my co-host and legal expert, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Our previous programs together are available as podcasts on alaskapublic.org. We covered how Alaska judges are chosen, how to find the right lawyer for your case, and we covered the anatomy of a criminal case. Our topic today is family law. The CDC tells us more than 2 million Americans will marry in a given year. Our marriage rate is 6.8 per 1,000 people, but our divorce rate is 3.6 per 1,000 people. So roughly 1 in 2 marriages don't last. And that's on the national stage. Alaska beat that in 2014 with a divorce rate of 4 per 1,000. Only 4 other states that year were higher than Alaska. Today on Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, we have experts who deal with this area of law. Its nuances are vast, from divorce to child custody to property division to grandparents' rights. All kinds of complex issues handled at a very emotional time. My co-host Judge Andrews proposed this topic for Justice Alaska because the caseload in Alaska Civil Court is huge. Many wheels in our state's legal system are engaged in moving family law cases forward. Before I turn to Judge Andrews, I want to welcome our listeners to call if you have questions or ideas about this area. And I also want to let you know that we have resources on alaskapublic.org. You'll hear us talk about lots of things related to getting information or even collaboration, mediation, things like that. And we do have those links on our website at alaskapublic.org. And you just need to look for Hometown Alaska. And I'm going to, just before we start talking, I'll throw out our numbers for listeners. If you're in Anchorage, feel free to call us at 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So welcome, Judge Andrews. I'm so glad to have you back. Why don't you introduce our two guests?
Well, I'm glad to be back, and I'm joined by two highly expert guests who are showing up today, volunteering their time on a gorgeous Alaska day. And I have Jacob Sonneborn. He is a born and bred Alaska lawyer and was raised in Anchorage, went to law school at the University of Wisconsin, returned to Anchorage. He is a partner in the law firm of Ashburn and Mason, where he has a very active family practice. I also have my guest, Janet Platt. She is a long-term lawyer here in Anchorage. She's been practicing family law for the last 30 years, and she represents clients in divorce cases that involve complex property issues, spousal support. She deals with things such as premarital agreements, and she is the recipient of many awards, including the first Alaskan to be named as a fellow of the International Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. So we have two highly gifted practitioners in the area who are going to help us wade through this complex area. And I think maybe, you know, with your introduction, one in two marriages fail, and these folks are people who help people in that process of going through divorce. So let me ask Janet, in your experience, which is pretty extensive, why do folks get divorced, and who gets divorced?
Every group in our community gets divorced. There's no one age group or neighborhood, religion, or race that is exempt. And people divorce for many, many reasons. There's drug abuse, alcohol abuse, domestic violence. Someone discovers he or she wants children. The other person decides he or she doesn't want children. Somehow that issue was not discussed before the marriage. And then in my practice, since my focus is on long-term marriages, I often see marriages that fall apart after the last child graduates high school and goes off to college. And typically nothing bad, nothing evil has happened in the marriage. It has died for a failure of water and fertilizer.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's a sad story.
Yeah.
Makes me sad.
And Jacob, what do you see?
I would parrot those same thoughts. Everybody gets divorced in my experience. I have had clients in their 80s, and I have had clients in their teens. Generally, I think divorce probably trends towards the younger half just because they are the ones that are going through it. And if folks have made it 40, 50 years of marriage, the chances are good that they'll keep on keeping on with whatever they've got. But I also would reiterate it is very, very hard to identify what issue, you know, there are all these sort of symptoms possibly or causes of the withering of a marriage. But fundamentally, I think you see people who have lost trust and respect for each other. And I agree, I do see a lot of folks who have gotten that last kid out and have said, we've both been wanting to do this for a while. It's been over. We've been holding on for the kids.
Okay.
And sorry to interrupt. Sure. I would also say that no doubt that Janet and I have biases in who we are seeing because we charge, frankly, an astronomical amount of money per hour to speak to us. And so we are not seeing, I think, a large segment of the population, but everybody gets divorced. Right. And my guess is that financial issues may play a larger role than Janet and I have experience with because folks that hire us, there's generally resources to go around.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, and those folks are people who are likely to go to the family self-help center where they do, quote, their own divorces. They pick up the divorce packets and they walk themselves through the system. And we had a program on that earlier where we talked about unrepresented people and what role lawyers
play. And we do have that
play.
Link on the website. It's the State of Alaska Court System Self-Help Center.
Correct.
Something like that. And then various topics, many, many topics under that. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, Janet, let me ask you. So someone decides that this really is something that has to happen. People don't generally make an impulsive decision to get married. How does this process begin? How do you suggest people begin the process? How do people come to you and what seems to be the concerns? And how do you begin to help them?
Typically, people come to me via referral from another lawyer or a prior client. And what I urge people to do, even before the first visit with me or any other lawyer, is to take some self-help steps. And by that, what I mean is, first, write out a list of the questions that are keeping you awake at night. It may be, am I going to be forced to sell my business? Is the court going to order that my children move out of state? Whatever the questions may be, so that during the time with the lawyer, you can be sure that your most pressing questions are in fact answered during that first session. The odds are good that the lawyer is going to ask you questions, but I think during that first session, you want to be sure that your most pressing questions are answered. So a short list for yourself. The other preparatory steps are, if you have a financial statement, many people have a financial statement because of lender requirements or bonding requirements, and so that's all ready to go. It doesn't have to be fancy. Just even a handwritten list of assets and debts. Gather up tax returns, 3 to 5 years of tax returns, personal returns, business returns, trust returns, whatever there may be. Same thing with financial statements. Get at least the most recent statements. If you don't know where they are in your house, snoop around a little bit in your house and find them. Also go online. Print out a credit report for yourself. You're entitled to 3 free credit reports a year. Print out a credit report. You'll find what credit cards are in your name, what mortgages there may be. I'd also suggest printing out a Social Security earnings history for yourself. So again, just getting some basic information together so that when you meet with your lawyer for the first time, or I should really say interview for the first time, that you can focus on what your concerns are, and you have some objective information to provide to your attorney.
May I ask a question, Elian?
Oh, sure.
I'm just curious, do you ever actually ask people about, have you gotten counseling, or do you recommend, before you do this, would you consider that? Do you do that?
In each and every case, during that first meeting, even before someone decides to retain me, I ask specifically what you have just uttered. Have you tried counseling? Even if someone has tried counseling years ago, I expect it would be possible to counsel again with a secular counselor, or someone through your synagogue, mosque, or church, through a women's group or men's group. I do recommend that people give it a shot before making the final decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would say the same. I recommend to almost everybody that I have a consultation with, not only that they give it another shot, I tell people, you know, my happiest call is I don't need you anymore because I'm not a fan of divorce. I also encourage people to get their own counselor. Divorce is highly emotional. There is not a single divorce that doesn't occur that doesn't have some emotional impact. And of course, most of them have huge emotional impacts. So I encourage people, I explain to them that at, you know, $300+ an hour, I'm an extremely expensive counselor. I am here for you. I will walk you through those things that I can, but you are going to be much better off taking a lot of those concerns to somebody who charges you significantly less to provide the sort of emotional support that you're going to need to get through the divorce.
I have another question. How often is it anger driven or just, you know, nothing, there's just nothing there anymore? You know, so sometimes I'm imagining does one partner come in and they're really mad at the other partner and they're like, or do they come in together? And how many times is it that it's just kind of a defeated situation? There is no anger, there's just resignation, I guess. You know, is there a mix of both, or is it, you know, the older marriages are the resignation, younger ones are the angry?
I see Jacob shaking his head.
Well,
no.
So in my practice, and I believe in many other people's, whether they know it or not, I identify the leaver and the leavee. They're a better predictor of how somebody is going to behave in their divorce, in my opinion, far better than age, gender, any other characteristic, is whether they are being left or whether they are leaving. The leaver, obviously, well, they all have their own challenges. They both have their own challenges, I should say. Mm-hmm. But generally, the leaver was angry and is now resolved to make a change. The leavee, you will hear, I've heard many, many times, this is out of left field. And of course, if you're speaking to the person who is doing the leaving, they say something to the effect of, the heck it is from left field. I've been saying this for years. Mm. And so of course, those, whether or not they appear to be calm, reserved, resigned in the initial meetings or in the first 10 meetings that you have with them or the first court hearings, ultimately, you see a lot of those emotions bubble up throughout the divorce, and you'll have somebody who appeared to you be totally sort of resolved to the fact and calm about it, all of a sudden behaving as those as you would expect somebody who was just served, you know, with divorce papers out of, as I said, out of left field.
You know, I have one story of a friend who, it's a couple. They went all the way. They were in court. They were in front of the judge, and the judge was ready to sign. And one of them said, I'm not ready. And they backed all the way out. So they paid for some pretty expensive counseling, I guess you could say.
But more power to them.
Yeah.
That's a great end
of
the story.
It's probably hard to do that, you know, because it's very emotional all the way, lots of pain. And yet, when it came right down to it, one of them was willing to try again, and they're still together today, and happily so.
Well, and awesome. I'm sure both lawyers here have stories of people who actually went through divorce and remarried after the divorce,
right.
And actually went through divorce again.
Two-timers.
Yes,
huh?
Two-timers.
Yeah.
It does
Wow,
happen.
That's amazing. Is that true? You're shaking your heads. You've had that.
Yes, and it's great to get a premarital agreement in between, but certainly my clients who have been with me for two divorces without a premarital agreement definitely have one by the third marriage.
They learn. We can learn. Well, I'm just in case folks have joined us late, this is Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, and my co-host and legal expert is Elaine Andrews, and we have two guests who are experts in family law, Janet Platt and Jacob Sonneborn. And we welcome your calls at 550-8433 or an email at hometownalaskapublic.org.
So you mentioned, Janet, a premarital agreement. Let's kind of start there and see, before you find yourself in a divorce situation, why would someone who no one enters into a marriage thinking they're going to get divorced, why would people have a premarital agreement, and how do you overcome that feeling of, if you really think this is forever, why do we need to have a premarital agreement? Don't you trust me? Yes.
Yeah.
So I often see this issue come up with my clients who I've represented them in their divorce. So they've already been through a divorce and now they wish to remarry. So they've had the divorce experience color their life. And while they are madly in love with their new beloved, they also understand the risk. And typically it's someone with substantial assets, maybe a business, maybe a professional practice, inheritance, lots of different ways that they've accumulated an estate. They want to make sure that they may have some protection for children of a prior relationship. They may want to opt out of whatever the standard rules are for the division of property. And a premarital agreement is a process that allows people to negotiate, and to negotiate at a time where everyone is happy and optimistic. And of course, any agreement that allows people to opt out of the standard rules still has to be fair at the time that it's signed and fair at the time that it is to be enforced. So if the terms are so unfair, either when it was signed or 30 years later when it is to be enforced, it would not be enforced. And so by that, what I mean is, if there's a premarital agreement that says everything I came into the marriage is mine, will remain mine, but also everything that I acquired during the marriage is mine. So there will be no marital property, and there will be no right to support. It is highly unlikely that type of agreement would be enforced down the road, particularly after a long marriage and children. So, and to answer your question of how do you persuade the other party to join in a premarital agreement? And again, this is at a time when people are very optimistic and want to also show their loyalty and their sign of faith to their spouse. And the agreement in many ways may provide for something more attractive than what the law would otherwise. So that the spouse who's not requesting the agreement still gets some benefits, and sometimes benefits that he or she would not get under standard
law. Does a judge approve these kinds of agreements, or how are you involved in them? Do you draw them up?
So a judge does not approve them at the time that they're signed. I negotiate, I draft, and then there is a signing. Both parties typically have independent counsel. I'm a strong believer that independent counsel is critical. So sometimes it's independent counsel and the other party doesn't want counsel. That's a more dangerous and challenging way to go.
Mm-hmm. Are they on the upswing, or it's been around forever and there's no change in what you see? And I'm interested in either one.
I don't think I haven't seen a particular uptick in okay. in prenups over the, I've been practicing in the area for 7 years now. I haven't seen a particular uptick in it. Janet has a longer
right.
period.
I've been practicing more than 30 years. So I think because of the demographics of our community with people getting older, I have seen more acceptance and more demand for premarital agreements.
Mm. Particularly in second marriages?
Oh, yes. Second, uh-huh. third, uh-huh. fourth, multiple marriages, absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes in first marriages where people are older when they married the first time, so they may already have accumulated substantial wealth. There may be a family business that they're operating with other family members. So there's, even though it's a first marriage, they have particular issues that they want addressed.
Yeah.
On that topic, I would just say that I often counsel people, that's a sort of a cocktail party question. Mm-hmm. Prenups are a common sort of topic of people who are not paying for my consult. and I tell people you don't need one. You don't. Nobody needs a prenuptial agreement. I think the stakes get right. And I say that the where I start to say you're getting close to that need is when you're playing with other people's money. When you're talking about not just your business, but the business that you're hoping will pay for children of a previous relationship or your parents' retirement or other, you know, if you're playing with other people's money, you really do need or you're getting very close to that need for a prenuptial agreement. I also tell people there is a common misperception that prenuptial agreements make divorce easy. They don't. And they can lead to litigation. You know, there is no avoiding the courthouse, really, if one party is determined to get in there. And while you can do things like making sure there's counsel for both parties, you don't avoid the courthouse automatically just by, even if you cross every T and dot every I in your prenuptial agreement. Hmm.
No guarantee.
A good attorney will find something.
Yeah, I think maybe sometimes I've seen a question that is so basic to this area, which is, I want to get divorced, but my spouse doesn't, so I guess I'm stuck. Both the lawyers are shaking their heads saying, no, actually,
you're not stuck.
You're not stuck. You do not need the agreement of another party to get divorced.
That's a good question. Actually, I didn't know.
So when you end up in court, for whatever, every divorce requires a court proceeding of some kind. When you end up in front of the judge, and let's make it a simple one, you're putting a settlement on the record. Everybody's agreed on everything. The court still needs to hear evidence to give it jurisdictional grounds and make some findings that are fundamental in every divorce. And
So when the person doesn't want to agree to the divorce and they're in court and the judge is trying to get them to answer questions and say, do you agree?
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Lane. One of those questions that the court has to make a finding of is there an incompatibility of temperament such that these folks can't remain married? You only need one party to determine to make that finding. Only one party needs to say, I'm done with this marriage. And I have had multiple hearings where the defendant generally is saying, no, I am not, I do not want this marriage. I think we could get along. And sometimes judges that are newer to the bench get very, very uncomfortable proceeding with only one party. But the law is very clear. You only need to find an incompatibility of temperament. And given the fact that marriage is a 50-50 arrangement, if one person's really done, I think it's pretty clear the marriage is done as well.
Interesting. Wow.
So, Janet, let me ask you the question. If you say a premarital agreement can change the general rules about property division, how would you describe to a client coming in kind of the general rules that are applied to property division? What's the overall kind of, you know, 1 or 2 minute kind of thing that the people have to learn about how this is generally going to go?
So, generally, there's a three-step process for property division. The first step is to identify the property that was acquired during the marriage. The second step is to value the property. And the third step is to divide the property. So the first step is often straightforward to identify the property acquired during the marriage. But sometimes it gets tricky. For example, what happens when someone had a premarital home and there was a mortgage that was paid for during the marriage, and there was remodeling during the marriage, and taxes were paid during the marriage. Our Supreme Court has said and has separated, provided special rules for a marital home. And that is that after you've lived in a marital home for some substantial period of time, all of the equity in the home, the entire value of the home, it becomes marital property. So the person who owned the home before the marriage, does not get any credit for that premarital investment. That's something that often people
are very disappointed.
Disappointed and shocked, frankly, to learn that they don't even get some credit under the law for that investment. The value of assets. How do you determine the value of an asset? We want to learn what we call fair market value. Willing to pay and willing to sell their property for. And so that's why we have accountants and appraisers, and it can become a very expensive and time-consuming process. So one way to avoid that process is to come up with some alternate ways of deciding what is property worth. And often people like that idea. Mm-hmm. And then, as you would anticipate, the third step of how do you slice and dice the property? People they like very much knowing ahead of time that regardless of the value of the business, the family business will stay on my side of the ledger, or the sailboat will stay on my side of the ledger, some particular piece of property. And premarital agreements address property issues. They may address spousal support issues. They never address child custody or child support issues. You cannot, in a premarital agreement, decide ahead of time child custody or child support issues.
So let me step in and ask Jacob, if someone comes into your office and you need to give them the sort of the quick overview of, you know, if someone comes in, they've got two kids, they've talked about divorce, but they haven't agreed about custody. What's the kind of thing you're going to tell them that they should expect if they're going to get into a disputed custody arrangement?
Well, I'll answer that question. I want to double back to the one of the very first questions you asked is sort of how should people prepare? And of course, I agree again with what Janet said regarding financial issues. It's far better for me to have a general idea of what you're talking about when you come in. But people oftentimes come in and say, okay, that's great. I know how to prepare the financial end. What do I do about the kids? And actually, with the children far more than the financial piece, I say my first piece of advice is take your time, because you are now talking about other people's lives. And the children of divorced couples remember these times, unfortunately, sometimes in far greater detail than they remember all the good times to come. So, be mindful of what you're exposing your children to in terms of your decisions to get divorced and why. I can give advice to people on how to have that talk with their children, but I think the most important thing to do when you're having that conversation with the children is to be on the same page with your spouse. I would say that's assuming that there are certain standards that everybody is going to meet when they're having the talk with the children, which is don't blame the children.
Children often do blame themselves. Yeah.
They absolutely do.
Do you, I have one more question. We're going to take a quick break here, but I do want to ask, do you recommend that children in a divorcing situation, do you recommend counseling all the way through the process?
And, well, I'm sorry to interrupt. Not perhaps all the way through the process. I leave that up to the mental health
sure.
practitioner and the parents and the child. But absolutely every single time. And it's disappointing to some extent how few people actually follow that advice and get their children in. But that's the most important thing when you're preparing for a custody. And maybe after the break we'll talk about what the custody, sort of the 101 of a custody case. But the most important thing is for people to take their time and remember that children need repetition. I tell people this, if you don't hear anything else, hear that the child will not remember the first time you tell them it's not your fault. They will all at some point assure themselves that it is their fault that this family is breaking up.
This or only that.
And so repetition is the name of the game. Yeah. I love you. It's not your fault. 3 times a day.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we're going to take a little tiny break. We are talking about family law, and we have experts in the studio, Janet Platt and Jacob Sonneborn, and of course, my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. We will be back. We will talk more about the difficult topics of custody and also things like grandparent rights. So there's more to come. I'm Kathleen McCoy. You're listening to Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska, actually Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. I'm here with Senior Judge Elaine Andrews, my co-host on Justice Alaska and a legal expert. And we have Janet Platt and Jacob Sonneborn here, family law practitioners. I don't know if you caught, you know, the last bit before we took our break, but it was for me, it was really hard to listen to that, to know how real the difficulties are. We were talking about children. Spouses. We kind of went through property for a while there, but then we moved to custody. So we're going to continue there. I'm going to throw out our phone numbers and then we'll pick back up where we were. 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide. And you can always email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Your questions are always welcome. So let's get back to this difficult topic.
So Jacob, what do you tell your clients about what the judge is going to do to determine custody? What are the things that the court looks at in order to make that difficult decision?
I tell people that the court is going to be looking at the best interests of the children, which is a oft-repeated phrase in family law and on the custody end. And therefore, while a parent's agreements regarding the children is obviously good indication that that's in the best interest, there's a separate standard that the court has to find. And to the extent that parents can't come to agreements regarding what is best for their children, a court will refer to a list of factors that the legislature has provided to help it determine the best interests of the child. And so I generally tick off a few of those. The court is looking at the needs of the child, the ability of each parent to provide for those needs. Any substance abuse issues, domestic violence is often an issue that comes up. And actually, when one looks at that list and sort of thinks about it, it really sort of gels into something that makes a lot of sense. The things that you would imagine are going to be that you would think would be important to determine whether or not somebody would be able to safely and effectively raise children are generally on that list. One that is a biggie, a lot of judges like to say, and I often say, is a factor that doesn't always spring to mind, which is the ability of each parent to encourage a relationship with the other parent. So this is the parent who lets the anger of the divorce, the anger at the other parent, negatively impact the way that they are either speaking to the children about the other parent or the way that they are treating the other parent around the child. So denigrating the other parent, the courts recognize, the legislature is recognizing, the courts recognize that that's a seriously damaging thing. These children are, they know that their parents are a reflection of them. They fundamentally know that they are made up of both of these parents. And to hear one parent put down by anybody is extremely painful to children.
And so, damaging, yeah.
And damaging. And unfortunately, it is, it happens far too often that people are not able to draw that boundary between their lives, the way they feel about their spouse, and the way their children feel about their spouse. Yeah.
You know, we have a caller, and I'd love to welcome them in. The topic they're going to ask you about is spousal support. So I'd like to welcome Rich to Justice Alaska. Hi, Rich.
Hey, how's it going?
Very good. Thanks for calling. What is your question?
I wanted to know about spousal support as opposed to child support, like when you can expect that people wind up paying it, or how long they're going to have to pay it past the actual court date. Like after the division of assets, would somebody still wind up having to pay spousal support? Why?
Okay. Do you know where to jump in? Okay, so
Janet.
Okay.
So the caller has identified two forms of child support. One is what we call spousal support, interim spousal support, which is what occurs prior to the final divorce. And then there sometimes is spousal support after the divorce. So for the shorter period of time, before the divorce, there are a number of factors to consider. If, for example, one party is at home, doesn't have an independent source of income, the other party may have to pay spousal support during the proceedings. For longer post-divorce support, our courts prefer that property be awarded and would rather that the trial court award more than 50% of property before spousal support is granted. In a short-term marriage, a year or two, it is highly, highly unlikely that any spousal support will be awarded post-divorce. In a marriage, a mid-marriage of maybe 5 to 10 years, there may be a year of spousal support to help with reorientation. There may be a fixed amount of support to help with rehabilitation, to help someone go back and get skills and training so he can be a productive member of the community and be self-sustaining. In a marriage of 40 or 50 years where one party is not working and the other party is still working and the estate is not sufficient to provide for the non-working spouse, there may also be spousal support. But it is a very rare situation to have long-term spousal support. Or unlimited or lifetime spousal support. It's very unusual. And of course, the larger the estate and the more liquid the estate, the more money that there actually is. So not just property, but money or assets that can be easily converted to property, then the less compelling it is to award spousal support because that part, the disadvantaged spouse should be able to take his or her share of the property and sell it, rent it, invest it, and live on that award.
Hmm. And then let me jump in, answer the child support piece. Rich, I think your question was a general one regarding child support. There are, of course, totally different things. There's a separate rule that deals only with child support, and there is no equivalent rule that deals with spousal support. Child support is is not something that, interestingly enough, is not something that you and the other parent can decide upon. That is, it is, you'll hear courts oftentimes, I think, overly simplistically say it's straight math. Your inputs into your formula can be something that you argue over, but there is a mathematical formula that determines how much a parent pays the other in child support.
And yeah, I was actually only wondering strictly about spousal support. And the only other question I had was, is how typical is it for someone to have to pay spousal support after a marriage when both parties have been working during the marriage, just one party was making more?
Very rare, I would say.
Yes, okay. I would agree. But it would depend again on the length of the marriage, what other marital property may be available, and if there are any special needs, such as if one party now has health issues that prevent that party from working, going out and being in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But certainly unusual.
I guess I would just say the one area that you might see it in is something that occurs quite frequently, which is you have both parties working, you have a significant amount of income, but they have spent everything that they've ever earned. And so as a result, you have a marital estate that is close to zero or even negative because they've run up so much debt. In that case, the court may well say if there's one spouse that's higher earning and there's an inability by the court to divide the property to sort of accommodate the fact that there's very little out there, you may have a situation where a court is saying this person has got to live and pay the debts and he or she is going to need some support from that in doing that from the higher earning spouse.
Hmm. Did that answer it for you, Rich?
Yeah, it gave me an idea.
Okay. Thanks for your call. We hadn't even gotten to spousal support, so that was great that he brought that up. So we were sort of dealing, because it seems so heavy, the emotional side of custody issues.
Well, and Jacob brought up child support, so let's close the loop
sure.
on that. So Jacob, what is the formula? There's a website that people can go to that can actually
do
the math.
Absolutely, I'm sure that link is available on the Family Law Self Help Center. There is also the Child Support Services Division offers a calculator, an online calculator that helps people determine. Because I will give it to you generally. First of all, you have to determine the amount of custody that each parent has. If one parent has more than, if one parent has 70% of the time of the nights with the children or more, they have what is called primary custody. And then that is a pretty simple formula. You figure the adjusted income of the non-custodial parent. You figure their adjusted income, which is that child support services calculator that I just referenced, will help you do that. And then it's 20% for one child, 27% for two, 30% for three, 33% for four, and 3% more for every additional child. Then you have, and then if you have shared custody, which is, again, I don't like these terms necessarily because I think that there's too much of a reliance on terms like custody when we're talking about
children.
Time with your children.
Mm-hmm.
But in a shared custody situation, it is slightly more complex. You're figuring the adjusted gross income, the adjusted annual income, of both parents, and then determining the percentage that the children spend with each parent, and a mathematical formula will spit out a result.
Wow.
If people earn exactly the same amount of money and have 50% custody, 50-50 custody, neither will owe the other any child support as long as the health insurance for the children is free, which is another wrinkle to mm-hmm. that the health insurance for the children gets wrapped into the child support as well.
Okay. But it is a cookie cutter formula, and this, we no longer have a situation where someone can say, you know, if you just give me custody of the kids, I won't ask for any child support. Those days have been long gone.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that's true. I mean, the courts will not accept that as a resolution to your child support. They will not issue a $0 child support order unless the math works out that way. And I tell people it is until child support enforcement gets involved, it's a private enforcement deal. The court is not going to follow up and make sure that she is paying the child support that she is supposed to be paying. But you're playing at your own risk there, because the statute of limitations on child support is very, very long. And I have been involved in cases where parents come in at the 11th hour, daughter is 17, you've never paid me child support, it's time to pay up. And it totals hundreds of thousands of dollars at that point.
I had no idea. That's amazing.
So while you can sort of enter into those private arrangements, it's risky, to say the least.
Yeah. I'm going to just toss our numbers out one more time. If you just joined us, we've been talking difficult topics around divorce, child support, property distribution, all kinds of things like that. If you have questions, you're welcome to ask them here. 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or you can send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. This is just a tacky question, but people... you see so much humanity in your fields, and I'm speaking to our two family law experts. But you know, does vindictiveness, does retaliation, does that loom large, or is that really sort of minor, and it's the bad cases? Or, I mean, you see the whole panoply of human emotions. I'm sort of getting a shaking head. No, it's not rare. How do you? Do you work at bringing out the best in people? How do you work with that situation? Maybe they want you to do, go get them for me or something like that. I mean, how do you deal with that?
So as lawyers, the first thing we get to do is also interview our clients to determine who we want as clients. And sometimes it's just not the best fit. So a client who during the first meeting may say, might identify a litany of behaviors that he or she didn't like during the marriage, and then says, and because of that, I want my spouse to get nothing. Or other behaviors, I want to take my spouse for everything. It's both unrealistic, but it may be that those marching orders are not the kind of marching orders that, it's certainly not the kind of marching orders I want to hear. So I'm listening for those cues. Harkening back to what Jacob said a few moments ago, depending on whether someone is the person who wants to leave the marriage or it's news to that person, those people are in a very different emotional state. The person who has finally decided to leave the marriage has processed a good part of the emotion and has worked through what we often refer to as the mad, bad, and now maybe at the sad. The other spouse may not have picked up on the cues over the years that the marriage was in trouble, or didn't want to hear it, didn't want to know it, ignored it. And so sometimes we'll say it comes as a shock out of left field. Mm-hmm. And that person is in a very different spot, so they have to catch up emotionally. And often there is that bitter, vindictive behavior coupled with finding it difficult to process information and finding it difficult to make good decisions. Because mm-hmm. when you're in that level of crisis, it is very difficult to mm-hmm. to make good decisions. So along those lines, what I would also say, going back to the child custody issue, is surround yourself with a good team of lawyers, counselors, support group, but do not turn your children, even your adult children, into your support group. Your children are not your counselors, they're not your advocates, and they cannot fix your marital problems for you. So I think people often recognize that with minor children, that they should not be discussing their marital issues with minor children. They should not be denigrating or bad-mouthing the other parent. But I think sometimes we forget that even with adult children, they are still children. Mm-hmm. And even if they ask questions, it is best not to involve the children on that granular level.
Hmm. Interesting. How about you, Jacob? What would you add?
Well, I would say that vindictive behavior, as you, I think it's a good term for it, is extremely difficult to identify, and there are more than a few people in town that will tell you that I have, you know, that I am. It is no fun to be in a divorce with me on the other side. We as attorneys owe a duty to our clients. And in a situation where you have no real way of knowing what is going on, and even if you did, the idea that behavior is strictly vindictive is impossible to identify. I had a case emails were revealed that the opposing party had written that said, basically, I don't care about the money. I want him, my client, to hurt and to hurt bad.
Wow.
Now, putting myself now in the position of the person representing that party, first of all, those emails are not generally sent to the attorney, right? They are presenting to you as somebody who is just trying to who's just trying to prepare for the future. The other part of that is that party, that spouse may have put it in a way that was not particularly was not a good way to put it, but she was suffering and she was trying perhaps to really actually defend herself against somebody who she felt had been a bully and was mistreating her in the divorce just as he had mistreated her throughout their marriage. And so even when you have sort of clear cut what you would say, this person is just vindictive, the question is what's really motivating that? Mm-hmm. And so when you're representing that party, like I said, not only are they identifying themselves to you as strictly vindictive, but oftentimes my biases lie towards believing in my clients. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they are, unfortunately, fighting for their future. And I don't think, I put the children in a different category. I'm not talking about custody
right.
issues.
Mm-hmm.
Although certainly people can be vindictive in custody cases and they can feel like they're fighting for their children's life. But strictly, even when we're just talking about dollars and cents, this is oftentimes the low income earning spouses. Well, it's both parties' last chance to build some sort of foundation to live the rest of their life on. And so it becomes very personal and very, very difficult to identify.
Mm, life like a life raft. I mean, they're thinking of how am I going to go on from here? So what can I take with me?
Oh, right.
That's really interesting. I know we have, 7 minutes or so, but some of the things I know we wanted to talk about was out of, custody with parties that want to leave the state, because Alaska's unique that way. A lot of people are here for jobs and maybe don't want to stay in a divorce. Can we touch on that just a little bit, maybe, Jacob?
It's got to be. Perhaps Hawaii has a similar issue, but
yeah.
But Alaska has got to have near the highest percentage of those cases where one spouse or the other was imported, or was not, or both parties are not here of their own volition, and of course Hawaii and Alaska would both have that issue of this is not we can drive and meet in the middle in Indianapolis, we can both drive 2 hours and meet in the middle. A minimum 3-hour flight for anybody, and that's if people move out of state. There are of course a lot of cases where people are internationally, even if they're still remaining in Alaska.
Oh.
You have big
sure.
geographic issues with shared custody. So that's a situation. I think I've heard judges on more than one occasion say, the really tough cases are where you've got two good parents and you're making a decision. Now, when both parents are remaining in the same community, it's not that it doesn't come to that very, very difficult level. But when one party is going to be leaving the state and the other party, or even moving down the road or up the road,
mm-hmm.
And the other party is going to remain where they are, now the judge is faced with a decision of, I've now got to make a choice. It's one or the other. And this is not to say that people won't have a significant relationship with their children and won't spend significant time with them. But if I think all of us who are parents can imagine being in a situation where you're going 8 months and seeing your children for 2 weeks or a weekend during a school break would be nearly impossible to confront.
And that comes down to the judge decides that? I mean,
well, if the parties can't agree, and of course those would be the sort of binary choices, it's me or him sort of choices that people say, I'm gonna roll the dice, I'm gonna see what the judge has to say.
Huh. And I remember actually very early on in my career, before I was on the Superior Court, when I was doing some family law work in district court, I had a case involving a fellow who lived in Barrow and a wife who wanted to move to New York, and they had a little boy, both fabulous parents. Very difficult decision. I was a relatively new judge, really struggled with that decision, and eventually the little boy went with his mom to New York, but the orders were that, you know, they would have lots of contact to the extent they could, but that when it got to be junior high, he'd come back and live with dad. And literally 20 years later, I'm in the grocery store and this person says, Judge Andrews. And of course, because of the work I do, that I'm always a little concerned about being recognized late at night in a grocery store in an aisle by myself. And he said, do you recognize me? I said, I do recognize you. And it was the father. And he said, I just want to let you know, it all worked out. I mean, you told us, stay in touch. Don't be angry with one another. Cooperate. He said, I have a relationship with my son. He didn't come back for junior high, but I have a relationship. We both remarried. We have nice families. My son is at the Air Force Academy, and I just want to tell you it all worked out. So that was so I remember losing sleep over that case very early on in my career. I've always thought about that child and what happened, and it was such a revelation to me when the dad told me that out of the blue 20 years later.
Right. I guess you hope for that kind of resilience.
You hope for that. You do. You hope for those results. I know there are other stories where the answer is not that.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk about same-sex marriage and divorce in that situation, and can we just touch on that briefly? We probably have 1 minute.
Plenty of time.
my question was, we talked about it a little bit before, which was, now that we have legal marriage for same-sex couples, if they aren't married, how does the court look at them? And we don't know the answer. That's yet to be discussed in...
You've said it all.
Yeah,
It's a developing area. It'll be very interesting. The idea being that courts treat unmarried people who have a relationship together at least slightly differently than they do people who have decided to get married. You don't need to go to court to break up with somebody. You do need to go to court to get a divorce. Well, now the question is, which category do same-sex folks who didn't have the option, what category do they fall into now that they do have the option? But that'll have to be the topic for another show.
Yeah, we say this all the time. We get going and we have to stop. So I just really want to thank our guests today. We had Janet Platt and Jacob Sonneborn, both family law practitioners. And, of course, we had co-host and legal expert, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. And thanks to our listeners and to our caller. Next week on Hometown Alaska, I'll be back as your host, and we're going to be talking about drones, the rules and the technology, and also what folks are doing with their drones. Pat Yak is our chief content officer. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thank you for joining us today on Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.